This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we welcome back Dan Malloy. He's the governor of Connecticut, and he'll take your calls and questions about a wide variety of topics. It's the first time we've had him on since he announced he was running for re-election, so we'll talk about that and other matters that he's looking at from his office at the state capitol. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. We're also live tweeting today's show. You can follow along at WNPR.org. And we welcome in the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, who are here today. Governor Malloy, welcome back to our show. Thanks so much.
It's great to be with you.
And you brought along Robert Klee. He's the commissioner of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. It's the first time we've gotten a chance to meet with you. Thank you very much, sir, for coming in.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the commissioner, Governor Malloy, you had a very high-profile commissioner, Dan Esty from Yale University, as you started off your job. What were you looking for in a new DEP commissioner?
Well, actually, more of the same. Dan did a great job, and our current commissioner was his chief of staff. They both have great educational credentials. They both have a number of degrees from Ivy League schools. They both have been active in energy and environmental issues in the past. And so I looked within the department for the new leader, and I found the person I wanted.
What do you see as your top priorities in your job?
Oh, in my job, we're an amazing agency that covers such a broad range of issues. So in each of our different divisions, we have enormous priorities, and really moving the ball forward on the governor's comprehensive energy strategy is priority number one on the energy side of the house. In the environmental quality side, the air, water, and waste, we have a really important bill before the legislature now on transforming the way we handle materials in this state, getting away from a use it once and in our case, burn it, to really driving deeper recycling and reuse of our materials and pushing us towards 60% reuse and recycling. And on our conservation side of the house, we actually had a really exciting week last week announcing the preservation of the preserve, 1,000 acres in Old Saybrook, Essex, and West and Westbrook that are really an amazing piece of coastal forest. So continuing our open space acquisition and celebrating the 100 years of our park system is a big event this year.
Yeah, Washington State is not the only state that has a coastal forest. And actually, this is the largest coastal forest intact between New York and Boston.
Mm. Now, you hinted at one of the difficulties, I think, or challenges, we'll say, of your job, which is that you have a large department that has a lot of different missions. And I've talked with your predecessor, Dan Esty, about this a lot. In the past, the DEP, the old DEP, was criticized a lot for not being business-friendly enough, not moving quickly enough for business. But then environmentalists sometimes say that the new DEP, adding the extra E, doesn't spend as much time worrying about environmental quality as maybe it could. How do you balance these things? Because you have so much under your purview. Energy and energy prices are very, very important. But all this conservation and environmental quality stuff is also very, very important.
Before the commissioner answers that, let me just remind everyone what's behind this.
Yeah.
And then if you think about pollutants, if you think about what is in the air, it is energy driven. So to not have these two things connected makes no sense. That's the whole envelope right there. In fact, we celebrated Earth Day last week. We celebrated it every single day last week. One of those events was about cars and car pollution and truck pollution. That's an energy source. Burning gasoline, burning diesel is how we get we move most of our goods and individuals around in this state. You can't disconnect the environment from the energy policy. They've got to be connected if it's going to work. Quite frankly, I think if the National Energy Department and the national environmental side were combined, it would be a better department.
One thing that I think
I took his time. You should let him answer.
But I'll let you answer. Go ahead.
I wanted you to understand what's behind
We both
want
to hear what you have to say. Yes.
Well, I'm always always the governor is always allowed to take my time anytime he wants. But no, it is, and this is the genius of our department, is that you can bring around the table the perspectives from across my agency around key issues. If it's the air quality that is related to our car or transportation problems, is also addresses climate change. And when you start thinking about energy issues and environmental issues together, you can bring together people who are interested in water and in our ecology and in our forests and in our fish all around the same table, and you get better results when those folks are all talking together and bringing their own unique perspectives to problems.
Well, so here's an issue that maybe will bring some of this up. We've been covering attempts by some state lawmakers, to ban fracking waste from being imported into the state. This is the waste that comes from hydraulic fracturing in other states. Hydraulic fracturing, called fracking, meant to get at natural gas in places like my home state of Pennsylvania. Now, it's unclear what's in these waste compounds. We're not exactly sure. Lawmakers want at least a moratorium on its importation, maybe an outright ban. Do you support such legislation?
We have supported legislation that would address this issue. We want the language to reflect that. For instance, we want your friends in Pennsylvania to purify the water that comes out of the well. Some stays in the ground, some comes out of it. There may be compounds in that process that are good compounds as you separate those things. So, what we're saying is let's make sure we understand what we're talking about. But if you want me to, in fact, let's be very clear. We want to stop right now fracturing a waste at the borders of the state. But whatever language is used has got to reflect the science and what is being recovered. The best fracking processes will be far cleaner than they are today. They will require purification of compounds that are removed from the well. This is all part of what has to be done. So we're not arguing about that. We want to stop this stuff at the border.
And I'll just follow on from that. We're in discussions with the chairs of the Environment Committee and the Energy and Technology Committee, with the governor's office, with my staff at DEEP, really crafting a bill that is really going to get at what is actually in this stuff, because that is a big mystery at this point. And we think that through a moratorium for a number of years while we are developing our regulations, we can then have regulations that require disclosure of what's inside this stuff, so you know how to treat it or manage it or dispose of it, and also information about whatever products might be derived from fracking waste, because that is actually an issue in other states where these waters that are produced during the process of extracting natural gas are being spread on roads as road salt. They happen to be very salty. We don't know what sort of radioactivity is in them. We don't know what other sort of chemicals and other carry-along sort of items are there. So the bill is really focused on just figuring out what is in there and whether and how it could be managed appropriately.
And, of course, one of the big questions is, because of federal law, we're unable to know some of the proprietary compounds the companies put into the ground. This was signed during the Bush administration, essentially saying, yeah, we know there's salt in there. We know there's some other compounds that come out of the ground, including naturally occurring radioactive compounds. What we don't know is what the company itself is actually injecting into the ground, because the federal government says we're not allowed to know.
Right. And that's a problem. And that's why we're going to pass legislation this session.
When you say stop at the border, tell me more about what that means. Do you mean setting up people at the borders, literally DEP agents saying this truck has fracking waste, you got to turn around?
Well, we should make it illegal to bring fracking waste into the state of Connecticut, at least with respect to a moratorium, until we have time to understand what's in it. And quite frankly, until we can demand of the companies they tell us what's in it. That's easy.
Yeah, I want to listen. Go ahead, please. Yeah.
And our facilities here that might receive that, if the truck pulls up to a wastewater treatment plant or one of our hazardous waste treatment facilities, they can't take it without knowing what's in it, because they wouldn't want to put mystery material into their sewage treatment plant, which could potentially kill the biological activity that's there to really make the sewage treatment plant work. So the facilities know not to take the tankers themselves. So we already have laws and rules in place that you basically can – that keeps the material from being processed. And we just want to make sure that we have the full disclosure, the full understanding of what it is, and then can move on from there.
We're talking with Robert Klee. He's the new commissioner of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, and with Governor Daniel Malloy, who joins us for his regular conversation with us. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We'll be getting to more topics with the governor in just a moment, but we did want to talk about this one. And I want to listen to a little bit of tape we got from Jim Sayre. layers. He's a professor of hydrology at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. He was talking to our science reporter, Patrick Scahill, about this issue.
Connecticut, like many other states, hopes to benefit from the relatively cheap and comparatively clean burning natural gas that's made available by hydraulic fracturing. And so it's not unreasonable to expect that with those benefits, perhaps the state of Connecticut should bear part of those risks.
So, Governor, I'll put this
to
you. No?
No, the answer is no. Let's be very clear. We may benefit from having the availability at market rate prices of a commodity, which is natural gas. But unlike Pennsylvania or New York, if they get into the business on a large-scale basis, or places like Texas or Oklahoma, we don't receive a fee, in essence a tax, on that which is taken out of the ground. That's their problem. Let's be very clear. Texas, you take care of your problem. You want to sell a commodity in the marketplace, you take care of your problem. Oklahoma, you want to sell a product on the marketplace, you take care of it. We have no obligation at all to accept waste from other states.
So, but if, say, a state like Pennsylvania or Texas says, well, look, we're not able to go anyplace with our fracking waste now. None of the states want this stuff. We've got to dispose of it locally, which means we've got to raise the price of natural gas. That's one of the many impediments I've spoken with your predecessor, Dan Esty, about.
Pay for it out of the excise taxes that you're collecting. These states, you know, this is one of the interesting things. They all talk about how low their taxes are, right? Well, but if you look at these states who are saying this, they're producing energy.
But what I'm saying is if their prices go up, then our prices go up. All of our investment in natural gas seems to hit a little bit of a roadblock if the price of natural gas in these other states has to go up for whatever reason.
Natural gas is so cheap right now, with additional amounts being found just about every day. That I'm not worried about the price of natural gas at the wellhead. I am worried about the price of natural gas delivered in New England, which is a whole other subject where I've been very active, as you know, with the comprehensive energy policy. The additional cost to the companies and to the states where the commodity is generated is a tiny, tiny fraction. They could do this right if they wanted to. They could do it right if Oklahoma and Texas and Pennsylvania, for that matter, had the right regulations in place.
And Governor, there are some states, Colorado is a good example, California is another example, where they are developing comprehensive regulations and that really do approach the extraction side in a sustainable manner. Yep. And we encourage our friends and neighbors to follow the lead that California and Colorado are
which is the debate that New York is currently having in its borders about how to get it right as opposed to get it wrong. And I mentioned the states that, in my opinion, get it wrong, by the way.
Well, let's get to the states that do it right. How can we, Commissioner, as a good consumer of this product, obviously we're investing mightily through the Governor's Energy Project in new natural gas transmission lines. If we're a good customer, we're going to be taking in a lot of this gas. Can we use this leverage to help pressure states to do better? Can we use this leverage to maybe just do business with states that already do it well?
We'll both answer this. That's exactly what we're doing. We're saying we're not going to take your waste. You handle it. That's exactly what we're doing. We are making our position extremely clear. I am very supportive of Gina McCarthy and her efforts to make sure that with at least respect to air pollution and water and ground pollution, that we have appropriate federal regulations. Now, the chances of having appropriate federal regulations with this Congress in place is pretty tough.
And we're working amongst the environmental commissioners. There's a nationwide environmental council of the states where we're approaching this issue from, you know, as fellow regulators and really having our sort of leading states help put friendly pressure and encouragement on the laggard states that it is possible and this can be done in a sustainable manner. And that's something actually the Energy Secretary Moniz mentioned when he was here last week. As folks are all sort of gathering around this sort of there is a way to do this right, and we find all the points of leverage we can to encourage folks to do it right.
But before we move on from environmental issues, let's go to a few phone calls. Brian's in Stanford. Hi there, Brian.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Governor, and thank you, Commissioner, for your time. I have a concern about a present concern rather than a possible concern in the future, and that is the nuclear waste storage issue, which has been ignored for the last 30 years by our federal government. I don't know how we can address it on the state level, but I know that since Yucca Mountain was built, they spent billions of dollars building it, and now we can't ship any waste there, and our waste is piling up.
Well, you know, this is an interesting question and speaks to the dysfunction in Washington. Right now, on there is federal legislation that prevents nuclear waste from these nuclear plants from being moved anywhere. That's what they, in essence, the federal law says if you're not moving it to Nevada, to the mountain, then you can't move it anywhere, which then locks everyone into storing on site. I think Secretary Moniz and my private discussions with him yesterday, last week, and he alluded to it as well, and he's done this before in the public, so I'm not breaking his confidence here. He believes that really what we should be doing is doing this on a regional basis, go out to a public process to allow folks on a regional basis to offer to the marketplace a safe way to handle this and store this as opposed to how we're currently storing it here in Connecticut. But that we're only storing it here in Connecticut because that's the only federal law that applies. We literally cannot move it.
A quick phone call from Margaret in Roxbury. Hi, Margaret.
Hello. How are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
In view of the possibility that we might move to a regional program, and our own remediation programs here in Connecticut are in the process of transformation, I wonder if it isn't premature to be asking DEEP to start writing regulations. Seems to me at this point you might start studying what you would do, how you would even begin to regulate this. What are the materials? What are the technologies? How much space do we have in capacity? So I'm wondering if you are thinking of regulations or thinking of a step before we begin to tell people to write regulations.
Well, you're talking about fracking waste specifically, Margaret.
Yes, I am.
Our position is that a moratorium needs to be in place, this needs to be looked at once we understand more fully what's in the waste. That's what we're trying to insist on, Commissioner.
Sure, and Margaret, thanks for the call. And I know this is an issue that you look closely at through your the work you do. And we are one of the quickest parts, though, of any regulation would be to close the federal loophole that John Tankosky referred to on just the characterization of these wastes as potentially hazardous. That would be a sort of an initial part. But any regulatory process would, of course, take into account sort of where we stand, how what our assimilative capacities are or are not, what sort of facilities we have or don't have. And that would be a process that would involve stakeholder input and through our normal sort of regulatory process.
A quick email here from Amanda who says, how about supporting legislation protecting Connecticut's treescape from overly aggressive tree cutting by UI and CL&P? We need to find balance between protecting the integrity of the electric grid and the amazing and life-promoting tree canopy in our state. I'm looking at you, Commissioner, but I have a feeling the governor might jump in first.
Well, no. This is an item that's gone before the appropriate regulatory body, PURA. And they've told the utilities to stop this over-aggressive cutting back of tree canopy and to come up with a proposal to do it over time. You know, one of the – we don't need shock and awe when it comes to residential streets. And part of the problem is nobody was doing enough for the last 25 years. If you try to play catch-up all at once, then you end up with scarred streets. If you do it appropriately over a number of years, it gives the trees time to reshape themselves.
And this is actually another great example of the benefits of our merged agency, is that we can bring our director of forestry and our forestry and ecology folks to bear into the more traditional utility regulatory process. And we're doing that. And we're actually been working. Actually, one of the governor's two-storm panel recommended a statewide vegetative task force that developed some guidelines that really are about balance, about having the right trees in the right place, about addressing the most hazardous trees first. and really understanding the broad array of benefits that urban trees in particular give. And that's something I'm happy to announce a new partnership between my agency and the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies to really explore the wide range of sort of economic, social, and environmental values of trees from both shading and from runoff and stormwater reduction. So having that better understanding of the sort of the broad array of benefits in addition to the benefits that are had by a more resilient pole and wire infrastructure.
A last thing for you, Commissioner, before I let you go and we take our first break and we continue on with Governor Daniel Malloy here on Where We Live. Again, something I spoke with your predecessor quite a bit about was this natural gas infrastructure plan predicated on the idea that he sees like a 10 to 20-year window of low natural gas prices in which we should invest, and that would allow us to get our renewable infrastructure up to speed, wind, solar, at least as much as you can do those things in the Northeast. Many people who are looking at wind power in the state have seemingly been stymied by the fact that we don't have good regulations in place for wind power turbines, that a lot of the credits for wind power are going by the wayside as we sort of dawdle on the idea of getting new wind power in the state. Where do you feel we are in renewables right now?
Well, I think we're actually in an amazing place in renewables, and actually the wind regulations have just actually passed.
They have now.
And it just, you know, 3.5 years after becoming governor of the state of Connecticut, we are buying 10 times the amount of renewable energy we were on the day I was sworn in. So we are doing, the whole concept of cleaner, cheaper, and more reliable is that concept. It's three basic points. We want cleaner fuels being used. Zero emissions are by far the best. Less emissions are second best. Lots of emissions is the worst. It's pretty simple. So it's got to be cleaner. Ultimately, with respect to the market, which is 50 states, it's got to be cheaper. And we need to build out a better grid and delivery system, both for the natural gas coming into the state to our electric plants, and the system to deliver that has got to be more reliable.
And with innovations from the governor has really pushed us, like the Green Bank, that we're really leveraging private capital. We're
first in the nation.
First in the nation green. Thank you. The first in the nation Green Bank that is really bringing market forces to bear and having folks compete on price. Instead of just waiting for a government subsidy, we're getting broader deployment by giving a less subsidy but having more volume. And it's actually been a change, particularly in the solar market, that they were a little resistant to at the beginning, but they're seeing how they can deploy a whole lot more solar on a little tighter margins and not be so reliant on the government grants and subsidies.
Robert Klee is the Commissioner of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Good to meet you. We'll have you back soon to talk more about the environment and energy here and Where We Live.
We'd love to come back.
You should give him a whole hour himself.
I will definitely give him a whole hour. Absolutely. Governor Daniel Malloy is here as well. When we come back from our break, we'll continue with some of your questions for the governor, 860-275-7266. We'll cover a wide variety of issues driven by your phone calls. Coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's our regular meeting with Governor Daniel Malloy, taking your questions at 860-275-7266. We'll get to some of your questions right off the bat. But I first want to ask you, you have announced that you're running for re-election, and you said previously that you might wait until May. You might wait until after the legislative session was over. What changed your mind? Why did you decide to announce now?
A couple of reasons. Number one, I was attempting not to make sure that the 10-10 minimum wage was not overly politicized in the sense of tying it to an election cycle. And so when I saw that we were going to get 10-10 done, which, by the way, speaks to women, 60% of minimum wage earners in Connecticut are women, and they are raising families. When I saw that we were going to get that done and actually be the first in the nation to do it, then I started to concentrate on what I was going to do. Had some conversations with my wife, Kathy. Had some conversations with Nancy Wyman, the lieutenant governor. She, in turn, spoke to her husband. We made a decision, and we announced it. And I'm happy we announced it, and people now know what we're doing. We're going back to the people of the state of Connecticut and saying we've made some real tough decisions. We inherited a state with a $3.6 billion deficit. we've turned that situation around. We inherited a state with no rainy day money, money in the bank. $1.7 billion had been exhausted from the rainy day fund in the couple of years before I became governor. We now have millions of dollars back in the rainy day fund. We've seen the creation on the private sector side of 52,000 private sector jobs. We've seen the shrinking of the size of government there during that period of time. We've invested in early childhood education. We've invested in college and university education. We're doing the tough things, and even on the environment. I mean, you know, I just gave you a statistic. We're buying 10 times the renewable energy today we were 3.5 years ago at better prices. We're doing some really tough, hard things that are hard to explain. So I think maybe in some senses getting out there and starting the explanation process makes sense.
Well, let's go to some phone calls. Mike's in Gales Ferry. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yes, John. Thank you. And thank you, Governor, for making yourself available here. Yes, I like a lot of the good things that you're doing. But one of the things I have a question about concerns the proposed budget legislation and specifically the 50% pension exemption for teachers.
Sure.
I guess this is modeled on the current military exemption. And what I want to point out, and I'm not sure you're aware of, is that those 50% exemptions, military and teacher, have no cap. There's no limit. In other words, six-figure pensions are eligible for a 50% discount. And I'm just a little bit disappointed that that is not there. Currently, your Social Security tax code limits exemption up to $50,000-$60,000 on Social Security income. And I'm just wondering, why can't, for fairness to all of us, why can't there be a cap of, let's say, 50 to 60 on the exemptions?
Okay, so it's an interesting idea. When I get back to the office today, I'll have a conversation around this issue. But let me tell you that it's not modeled necessarily after the military. What it was modeled on is we looked at what the average pension for teachers is. Putting together the highest earners and the lowest earners, what is the average? And basically we got to 50%, which is a way of giving them, in current dollars, the rough equivalent treatment of that portion of their pension, which would, if they had been eligible for Social Security, would not be taxed. So I understand what you're saying about the similarities, but that's actually how we got to the 50%, was to have it as reasonably as possible match across the border, across all of the folks who would be collecting a teacher's pension, have it match how their Social Security, if they had been eligible for Social Security, would have been treated.
Doreen is in Hartford. Hi, Doreen. Go ahead.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
Governor, what I want to know is there are about 28,000 lawyers in the state of Connecticut. I don't know how many are on the list to be a judge, but how can you possibly justify appointing people to the bench who will serve 2 or 3 years?
Let's stop.
Including health insurance.
Sure. So let's stop for a second and say that number one, I'm not appointing anybody who's only going to serve 2 years. So let's just stop there. I think it's four. With respect to that, first of all, I have no right to discriminate. Unless you really believe we should be discriminating based on age, we don't have a right to do it. That's number one. Number two, when I interview candidates, particularly candidates who are at the higher range of age, I have a very clear discussion. And my discussion is, hey, how long do you plan on working? And are you making a commitment to work, understanding health and everything else? Are you making a commitment to work beyond the age of 70 in as a judge or a trial referee or a retired status? If the candidate indicates that that's what they're desiring and they make a commitment that that's what they're going to do, understand that the pension and benefit package is offset by the amount of money that they would earn on a part-time basis doing the same job. So in essence, what we're going to do is not get 3 years or 4 years or 5 years out of some of these candidates. What we anticipate is we'll get 15 years or 12 years out of these candidates, and their pension system is specifically tied to offset that differential. Thank you.
Doreen, thank you very much for your phone call.
And actually, let me point out one other thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need to get certain judges who have backgrounds that dig deeper into particular areas as a point of expertise within the system. And sometimes that requires you to do things.
One of the plans that we've talked about is your rebate to taxpayers, $55 a person. It seems to be questioned by some lawmakers at the Capitol, including top Democratic lawmaker Martin Looney, seemed to float the idea that this rebate might need to be scrapped or reduced if income tax filings don't improve. We saw April 15th, the numbers didn't come in probably the way your administration would like, falling, you know, maybe $300 million short of expected levels. So I guess the first question is, are we seeing the taxes come in the way that you were hoping around April 15th? If indeed we fall short on that, do you have to scrap or scale back this rebate to the citizens?
Quite possibly. We'll speak to that later today. We're going over numbers. You know, it's interesting. What appears to be happening is certain taxes are overperforming and certain other taxes are underperforming. And I think we know why, and we're going to speak to that issue a little bit later today. And of course, any of those changes up or down has to be reflected in differences. Let's be very clear. They aren't simply our numbers. They're the consensus numbers that we're predicting what would come in. But I think when the story is told, and I think we'll be in a position to tell it later today, people will understand exactly what happened.
So when you say later today, are you going to announce that you're changing the package that you've been talking about?
What we're doing and we're working on, we were working on through the weekend, is a new set of projections and how they'll drive policy. We're going to end the year in a surplus. We're going to have budgets that reflect surpluses. The size of the surplus will probably require that some things not be done and other things be done. But these are my priorities, jobs and education. So we're going to continue to support those things as paramount. You know, one and two, jobs and education, education and jobs. You decide which is one and which is two. Beyond that, and by the way, above that is that we have budgets that produce surpluses. Beyond that, you know, I think that ultimately everything has to be on the table. We'll be talking to that later today.
When I've spoken with you about this in the past, you know, the rebates like this, when they've been done in prior administrations, have been criticized. Governor Roland very famously did something very much like this. At this point in 2014, $55 a person is a tank of gas. It's not even quite a tank of gas for me. And I asked you about this, and you said if we've got the money, we should be giving it back to the people of Connecticut.
Sure.
Now, if we have to go back to them and say, look, we're not able to give you that money because we haven't gotten enough of your tax money, what sort of message does that send to people?
Well, I think this is interesting, John. I just want to play back your words for you.
Sure.
You were against it happening, and now you're worried that...
I'm not against anything. Well, I'm just asking you questions. No, that's my whole deal.
Yeah, sure. And mine is to respond to it.
Sure.
And that's why I enjoy the show so much. People question whether we will do it, and they question whether we won't do it. What we're going to do is treat it the way a surplus should be treated. If there's a large surplus, if there's not a large surplus and the surplus is smaller, then you do other things. And that's the way I've always run the city of Stamford, the state of Connecticut. Again, you know, we are seeing growth. We're seeing jobs being added. We're seeing real economic strength, but there is one area of taxes that seems to be coming in a little bit slower than folks had anticipated. I think we'll be able to point out to why that is, and as I said, we'll speak to that later. But what I am saying is, you know, the $55 wasn't item number one.
Sure.
Item number one was to make sure that the vast majority of a surplus goes into the rainy day fund. That's item number one. Item one is jobs or education or jobs. Next, making sure that substantial amounts of any surplus go into the rainy day fund. After we do that, if there were monies left over, the idea is taxpayers have seen a tax increase in the past. Let's share some of the additional monies coming in that they might they should share in, as well as pension payments. Let's go to the pension payments. The legislature seems unwilling to approve legislation that would allow those larger pension payments to go in into those accounts and change how you would treat it for accounting purposes. So what I think we're saying is, listen, we should be really happy. We've gone from a $3.6 billion deficit to a surplus. We've gone from no money in the rainy day fund to money in the rainy day fund. We did cut taxes last year. We're going to continue the process of cutting taxes. To the extent that we're arguing about how we spend the surplus, that's a nice argument to have.
The reason I asked you about it before is I asked you about it prior. in the context of, is it good policy to be taking a small surplus and spending it on rebates? And now that you're a declared candidate, I guess my next question is it good politics to then say, well, maybe we can't give you this surplus because you're a candidate for governor.
Sure. So let me help you examine it from a different way. When I was here last, I pointed out that the average cost of the gas increase per car was about $18.50. $55 more than covers that. However, if we had cut that tax already, as opposed to being prepared to rebate it or refund it, then we would lose all of that additional revenue from out-of-state drivers who fill up on 95 or 84 or along the highways and byways of the state of Connecticut. So a refund was a way of lowering effectively Connecticut citizens' taxes while at the same time effectively collecting revenue from those folks who are driving through our state. It's not a bad idea, John. It's not a bad idea to give people who live here, raise their families here, work here, a break when you can, and by the way, still collect revenue from out-of-staters and highways and byways.
Just from the politics angle, I guess I'm just wondering if it makes sense, though, to offer it to them and then have to come back and say, maybe it's not going to be what we said. That's all. That's my only point.
Oh, sure. No, I think that more money is better. Less money is less good. But a surplus is what's important.
I want to get to one more topic before our break. And this is, we've talked about a number of times, but it's made its way back into the news. There were a few bills out there that would repeal the gambling game Keno. It was something that was put into law by lawmakers. It was never enacted, really. We don't see any Keno gambling anywhere. A lot of people don't like Keno. Polls say Keno isn't something that people in Connecticut really love. But those bills seemed to be going nowhere. If a bill actually made it to your desk to repeal Keno, would you sign that bill?
Yes.
Okay.
I've made that very clear, John, and there really should be no doubt about it. If a bill repealing Keno is passed, I absolutely will sign it.
But do you support the idea of Keno as a possibility for making up this shortfall in revenue if indeed we don't see tax revenues coming back in this year and the next year?
It's not the way I would do it.
It's not the way you would do it.
No, and by the way, we're not going to raise taxes, and we're going to have budgets that produce surpluses. I'm not a Keno advocate. I know that there are advocates in the legislature. I know that there are people who don't like Keno. I understand all of that. It's got to get to my desk. But I was very clear, I think before the session even started, that legislation came to me, I'd sign it.
But are you going to push for repeal of Keno?
I think I just did, John. I said I called for it, which I did before the session, and I've repeatedly said that I would sign it. So I am calling for it.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, a lot of people want to ask questions about education and other things. You can join us 860-275-7266. We're also live on CTN today. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, a look at the relationship between social consciousness and the arts. A panel of local artists and musicians share how they're using art to raise social awareness and promote positive change. I hope you can join us for that conversation. Today, we're talking with Governor Dana Malloy. It's his weekly check-in with us. We're taking your calls at 860-275-7266. Go to Beth in Hartford. Hi, Beth. Go ahead.
Hi, Governor. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling in reference to the lawsuit filed by the Democratic Governors Association.
Sure.
And I just want to know if I understand their reason for filing, because they want to protect themselves against things that might rise up later. But can you do you have any idea how long the court's going to take to make that ruling, or maybe elaborate a little bit more about why they're, you know, in a defensive position like that, when they shouldn't be?
And this is a lawsuit against the State Elections Enforcement Commission.
Well, yeah, apparently there's a dispute between those two organizations, the state's organization and a national organization, with respect to how independent expenditures should be made. Let's be very clear. I think the Supreme Court has really messed up America in the Citizens United, and now even more recently in the McCutcheon decision. I would prefer a United States where expenditures have reasonable and appropriate limitations, both by parties, candidates, and third parties. And when I said – when I referenced parties, I meant Republican, Democratic, working family, independent, whatever. So you know, this is a weird out-of-body experience to be engaged in because in one hand, I think that the Supreme Court, going back 4 years ago, began the process of dismantling a system that was built both on the federal side and state by state. But now and so I condemn the United States Supreme Court for what they've done. And I think in retrospect, we will look back and say that this is as bad as any decision or sets of decisions has ever been made by the Supreme Court. Let me point one of the things out. The Supreme Court says that a foreign registered corporation has to be treated as if it was a citizen of the United States with respect to its ability to spend money in elections. It is a terrible concept. It's un-American. I couldn't use a verbiage that would be strong enough and be playable on this radio station. So I'm not there. Now, you know, when groups have a disagreement, they try to come to an agreement if they can. If they can't, they go to a third party, and that's what's happening here.
We got a tweet from our friend Dr. Kalila Brown, Dean from Quinnipiac. She asks, will the governor's push for universal pre-K emphasize the importance of full-day pre-K in kindergarten? She adds, access to full-day program is important for working parents. In this context, I know that your administration has a plan for expanding pre-K slots. I think the legislature has a slightly different plan. The costs are slightly different and the way they're structured are different. Maybe you can explain for Dr. Brown-Dean a little bit about how you plan to move forward on pre-K expansion.
Sure. What I have said in the past is that no child should be denied a pre-kindergarten learning experience based on their parents' financial circumstances or their zip code. Now, that does not mean that we build, an extra year or 2 years in the kindergarten. What it means is that we step in and make sure that no child is denied that opportunity. That's the thrust of my proposal. It uses the school readiness concept that we have here in Connecticut, working extremely well, as the appropriate approach to this issue in the future. We will fund 1,020 additional pre-kindergarten learning experience slots that could be filled as early as this late August or September. Let me address the specifics of the message. I believe full-day kindergarten is the right way to go. I happen to come from a community that's probably had full-day kindergarten for the better part of 50 years. I don't understand why other communities have not universally moved to that, but that's a local decision, and that's been left to localities to make that decision. I believe the best learning experience on a pre-K basis is full day. I think it's the best is full day, full year, quite frankly. So I will go to the best, use my best efforts to see that these programs are full day, and to the extent that some number or all of them could be full year, I think that's a great idea. And certainly that's what I promoted as mayor in the city of Stamford when I brought the concept of universal pre-kindergarten first in the nation city to stake a claim to doing that.
Another education question we're getting a lot of is there are many parents around the state who are concerned about new testing requirements around the Common Core, and they have gotten some fairly confusing answers from the State Department of Education and others at the local level about whether or not they and their children can opt out of these tests, can essentially say, we don't want to take these tests around the Common Core. In your view, can parents and students opt out of these new testing requirements?
I don't believe that that's consistent with federal law, quite frankly, and would endanger our agreement with the federal government with respect to limiting, in essence, what we've done testing and limiting certain other bureaucratic requirements under the existing federal law, No Child Left Behind. For instance, I read over the weekend that at least one state is about to be defunded to the extent of about $40 million for their lack of compliance with their agreement with the state. I certainly don't want to see our state fall into that situation. So we're making a lot of progress in the last, I'd say, 4 weeks, both on the Common Core implementation. Remember, I didn't adopt Common Core. My predecessor did. Handling the deficit, I was also handed the problem of seeing this implemented. Some districts are far ahead of other districts. Some districts folded their arms and said, we'll wait and see and we'll introduce it when when we're actually required to. Other districts like Wallingford began implementing in 2010. So we have this disparity, but that disparity reflects who we are and what we are in education in Connecticut. It's a collection of 164 or so different systems that have certain rules that apply on a federal level, a state level, but a lot more of the rules are simply made on a city-by-city, town-by-town, district-by-district basis.
But at least one prominent member of your Board of Education, the Board of Education in the state, has said that this wouldn't – this legally would not hold up, that essentially parents and students should be able to opt out. It sends a confusing message, I think, to the parents and students about what they can and can't do, especially around something that's so controversial and they have so many questions around.
Well, listen, from a guy who grew up with dyslexia and had real physical as well as perceptual difficulties, I understand people's anxiety about testing. I certainly had my own. On the other hand, let me leave this to the commissioner, and I've kind of given you what my read of the law is, and that is that we must be compliant with the mandates of No Child Left Behind as it currently is implemented, and that requires all of the states to be engaged in some form of testing. By the way, having said all of that,
yes.
I'm the guy who made sure that nobody had to give two tests this year. We would have had about a third of our school districts having to give both the new Common Core testing program as well as the old state program. Last August, I think it was, I moved and we got a waiver from the federal government to make sure that that wasn't the case. We then left it up to all of the municipalities. You can give the old state test or you can give the Common Core test. You make the decision. This is not a state-driven decision. You make the decision. 80% of the communities decided to go with the new regime. They made that choice this year. We didn't. I didn't impose that on anyone. The commissioner didn't impose that on anyone. That was a choice that was made at all 164 districts.
But you said that your predecessor essentially signed the Common Core changes into law. Do you support largely what the Common Core is trying to do? I mean, if you could do something in your next term, if you are reelected, would you substantially roll back what's been put into place right now? You would not.
No, I would not. I would not. I think that you look at the United States. At one time in the industrialized world, we were number one or two in almost all categories across the board with respect to education measurement. I think the consensus is that we're now around 16th place. If you look at STEM in specific, science, technology, math, and engineering, it is a particularly strong weakness in the United States. Now, why do I focus on that? Because our economy in the United States has historically been driven by innovation. Innovation largely is driven by science, technology, math, and engineering. If we continue to lose our competitive edge, and we have lost it with respect to many industrialized nations already, then it's going to be very difficult for us to allow our economy and our nation politically as well to evolve the way we would like to see it evolve, including additional employment on a national basis, if we don't step up our game.
We just have a few minutes left. And just there's one last sort of political question. This whole education issue has gotten a lot of people on the progressive, the liberal side of the Democratic Party, not only concerned here in Connecticut, but in neighboring states as well. I'm wondering what you think about the possibility of a challenge for the primary. We heard from John Pelto, a very prominent blogger who blogs about education. He was on Dennis House's program yesterday. We don't have time to listen to any of that, but he's talking about the possibility of running in a primary against you.
Everyone has a decision to make about their own policies. But let's be very clear. The job of governor is about taking on big, tough issues. One of the weaknesses in Connecticut is that we didn't take those on. When I was elected governor of the state of Connecticut, we didn't have an energy department. We now have one. We didn't have a housing department. We now have one. We had a $3.6 billion deficit. We now have a surplus. We had no money in the rainy day fund. We now have money in the rainy day fund. We weren't moving on educational reform and appropriately funding education. We're now funding education to a greater extent, and we're trying to find the right way to reform on a collective basis. Higher education needs had been ignored. We're now funding higher education at a higher level than we were before. Let me go back to energy. We had no energy policy in the state of Connecticut, specifically with respect to the highest energy cost electricity in New England, actually second highest in the nation. We now have a policy designed to drive that down on a comparative basis. We've made a lot of progress. We've also made a lot of tough decisions, and I'm proud of how we've moved the state forward. And that's on top of 52,000 private sector jobs and a smaller government.
There's obviously a lot more that we could talk about, but we've run low on time once again with Governor Daniel Malloy. You can keep your questions coming at WNPR.org. Governor, thank you very much for coming.
Great to be here. It's always fun to be here.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.